Hello and welcome to part two of the GRK podcast Switch special. About a month or so ago, we had a podcast which was all about our kind of hype for the Switch and our hype for Zelda. And now, you know, some time has passed and we've all played it. So joining me here today is Shankar, aka SuperDragon64, who's going to be helping out and kind of co-hosting this podcast.
Hello.
Chris, aka Cheeky Devlin, who's very kindly taken some time out from streaming to be with us and have a chat about the Switch and Zelda.
Hello.
And finally, Pete, aka Peds.
Hello.
So before we like jump in to talking about Zelda and what we think of it, I should just say as like a little public service announcement, we are basically going to be talking about the first area of the game, which is the Great Plateau, and the area to like the immediate east of the Great Plateau. Those are the two areas that we've all been to here tonight. So there might be some like very mild spoilers there. If you really want to remain completely spoiler free and you haven't played Zelda yet, we're going to try and keep story details and stuff like that as vague as possible, but you might want to wait until after you've, you know, played for the first few hours before you listen to this. Okay. With that out of the way, let's jump in. Zelda has been rated 10 out of 10 basically across the board. I think like Easy Allies gave it 9. Jim Sterling gave it 7, which we might talk about a bit later. But I think it got 10 in Edge. It got 40 in Famitsu. Really high praise from games journalists basically everywhere. Shankar, does this game deserve that level of praise?
It definitely does. I got the Wii U version a few days before it came out because I was that excited to play it. I was even happy enough to just play on the Wii U while I waited for the Switch to arrive. And it definitely deserves it for a lot of reasons. Not just because it's taken the Zelda series to a new direction for the series in that it's gone away from the formula we've had since Ocarina, where you're given a quest and you go through, say, 3 dungeons, and then your storyline expands to give you a reason to go to some more dungeons. Whereas this time you're just free to go wherever you want, and you've got a basic structure of framing the whole game. But it also gives you freedom in that it doesn't hold your hand, which is a big problem with the last home console Zelda game, Skyward Sword. So instead of being spoon-fed every step of the way, you're literally just put into a world. And it's up to figure out how do you survive, really. So really, yeah, it's definitely deserves the praise.
So Nintendo have basically completely shaken up the Zelda formula in terms of the gameplay mechanics which are available. There's a much heavier emphasis on exploration in this game than in previous Zelda games. An absolutely huge map, which is full of things to do. It's very dense, but with very little signposting, an initial suggestion of like the direction in which you might want to head. But beyond that, really the game encourages you to go everywhere. And what I've liked is that NPCs will like drop little like hints, like little location, you know, they'll name drop locations, you know, on the other side of the world, and they go, oh, there's something interesting there. And you kind of get the sense of, you know, you aren't being, like, railroaded anywhere. There's, you know, interesting little points scattered all over the place, and the game is basically encouraging you to go to any one of them that you like. And I think that's demonstrated here, because we almost kind of struggled to find, we hadn't gone to the same places. And we had to really narrow it down to, like, you know, basically a couple of regions that we'd all visited. and that we could like talk about more freely so that we don't spoil bits of the game for each other. So that I think that element of exploration has really been like what's separated it from previous Zelda games. I think it's really tied into like the kind of sense of adventure that it builds up, and it really does feel like you're like heading out into the unknown and like discovering new things, and it really does have that like sense of adventure for me. I was just gonna say I really agree that it does deserve the kind of 10 out of 10 praise for that alone, for being so successful in bringing that like excitement of like adventure and exploration to like the Zelda formula.
Yeah, I agree, and this is and the way it's done it is definitely a reason why it deserves its praise. I was kind of worried initially that there would be a big open world and I'd get bored of it like I do other open world games like Skyrim and GTA. But Breath of the Wild keeps your attention because in this huge, and it really is huge, world, you have a lot of shrines which incorporate the traditional Zelda puzzle gameplay, and that's one of the things I enjoy most about the Zelda series. So having those peppered around the world means that I'm exploring the world, but then it's not just to do more kind of mindless A to B delivery quests. I'm exploring it to find these puzzles and then solve it, and the way they're all so well woven together is a big part of what makes this such a great game and why it deserves all that praise, in my book at least.
Absolutely, and with the shrine system, since you bring it up, I think this probably has the highest density of like high quality Zelda puzzling of any Zelda game. I mean, you're constantly exposed to this constant trickle of interesting puzzling because you just happen across these shrines, and these shrines are like small and focused enough that they can like focus on an individual interesting idea. Does that make sense? Like it's almost distilled that aspect of Zelda games down into like the purest possible form that it could take. And I think that's like a really positive move that's really helped like keep this game interesting as you're exploring.
Yeah, no, I mean, I would agree with that. It's like as you're moving through the world, there's always something to discover, even if it's, you know, just a little secret corner here or a little, you know, bit of gear here, or in, you know, the good cases, you know, the shrines, you know, where you do have these kind of, you know, almost dungeon like type puzzle sequences, and for me that's half the fun of it. You know, you're constantly finding new things and getting new rewards, and the shrines play a big part in that for me.
One thing I enjoy about the shrines, and it's not to do with the shrines themselves, it's more to do with, you know, you climb this massive mountain. You can see around for miles, and you can see all these shrines dotted, and you mark on your map, and it's like, yeah, I could do the story, but there's these shrines to do, and they are fun. So, you know, you get that, and it's a cool bit of exploration then, because it makes you go out your way to do more.
Yeah, absolutely, and you're, like, following your heart. You're like, oh, what will be, like, a fun place to go next? You never feel like you kind of have to go anywhere. It's you spot a shrine on the horizon, or a tower, or whatever, you're like, yeah, let's go.
That's one of the, again, things that make this game stand out to me as opposed to other open world games, in that the exploration I know will be worth it because of these shrines. I know that I'll find a puzzle that will make me think and give me something to do that's more than just, okay, go to this place and talk to someone or drop this item. And that's why I've spent so long and so much of my time just exploring the world, trying to find these shrines and other secrets, because more often than not, it will be something engaging and something and in itself a big loop of gameplay. So I don't find that, okay, I don't find that I'm driving myself towards a dungeon to get the bulk of the gameplay experience. That is literally spread around the world. This is one thing I kind of don't like. This is the kind of low point for me in not just Zelda games but other RPGs. Well, I know that Zelda isn't really an RPG, but it's a similar feeling I have with RPGs. So when it comes to going to towns and you have the downtime, I find that the less enjoyable than the actual gameplay bits, whether they're dungeons or combat bits. So having this all around the world means that I'm pretty much always close to something I want to do, whether it's actually go to a town and interact with NPCs, or just go out into the wild and fight some enemies, or to dig up some treasure, or solve a puzzle in the shrine.
Yeah, absolutely. I think that's the constant like mixing of content means that you don't get bored with any of like the constituent subcomponents of the game's mechanics. It's been very cleverly designed in that respect, I think.
Mm.
So we promised to be kind of vague, so let's not kind of give away, you know, the solutions or too much. But Chris, what has one of your favourite shrine puzzles been so far? Just to give people listening a feel for the kind of things that you're doing.
It's hard to say because I've done that many of them now. That I'm trying to pick out one that really stood out for me. For me, it's probably the ones where it starts combining multiple kind of powers that you've built up. So earlier on, you'll have ones that use, like for example, stasis. But you'll have ones that use the remote bombs, or you'll have ones that use magnesis. And then as you go further on, you start getting ones that require you to kind of combine the two. So it'll be like you'll need to maybe freeze something from stasis and then use magnesis to do something else while it's doing that. So it's the ones that, like I said, have got kind of layers of a solution on them, where you're using multiple things to solve them. And there's been a couple of them like that that I really enjoyed doing. And even ones where, you know, it's maybe, you know, fairly simple, you know, what you have to do, but there's maybe a quick or a kind of shortcut kind of way to do it. I think, again, not without going into too much detail, but certainly on one of the, I think there's a couple of motion control shrine puzzles. There's ways that you can, you know, playing with the controls that you can do, make it either easier or harder for yourself, depending on what you're doing. There's some tricks you can do that make it much, much simpler. So I quite like that, you know, ways that, you know, you can kind of turn it on its head, so to speak, and make it easier than perhaps what the obvious solution would be.
Mm. One thing I've noticed as well is that the shrines, they often have like a kind of basic solution that give you the main reward, but then there are optional rewards that if you do something really clever, you'll notice, oh, that, you know, up here hidden in this corner there's a chest or whatever.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, yeah, so you'll have like a lot of the time you'll have a basic solution to it, and then there'll be another chest that uses the same mechanics, the same ideas to solve it, but you've maybe got to go one step further with it to get to it. And they usually contain something worthwhile to an extent, although the further on in the game you get, the rewards you get maybe aren't as good as the stuff you've already got, which is something I've found a couple of times now. But certainly you've got those, you've got the kind of basic challenge, and then you've got an additional one if you want to try and get something on top of that.
The one thing that's cool about the shrines is the actual variety of shrines. There's like several different types of puzzles. There's combat, there's the motion-based ones. There's a lot of variety in the puzzles themselves, which is really good, because when you've got 100 of them, you're going to be worried that they're going to get kind of samey. But so far, they haven't. They've been varied enough for each one to be enjoyable in their own right.
Yeah, I mean, it seems to me so far that there's maybe about 9 or 10 different types that you get, and then so you'll have a very basic version of one early on in the game, and then later on you'll find one that's maybe using the same idea but taking it a step further, and then kind of building on it. And I found that with a couple of them, and especially obviously, like you said, the combat shrines. You know, there's a few of them that I've came across, the kind of later level ones, and I'm just like, nope, and had to leave because I just can't handle them yet.
I think that one way the shrines keep themselves from becoming too repetitive is that, in a way, they serve to kind of replace dungeons that we see in traditional Zelda games. So whereas you'd start out with a dungeon, or with the game leading you to a dungeon in the first hour or so, in Breath of the Wild, you're directed to 4 shrines that you have to complete as kind of the tutorial. And then on your way to the next story marker, you will come across other shrines. So instead of being funneled towards another dungeon and inside that series of puzzles, you're just there exploring the world, and all these puzzles that used to be in one place are now just
spread around the world for you to discover if you want or if you don't want. So that helps it stay fresh, but it also means that you can tailor the experience to what you want. So if you did like exploring the world more than going into dungeons, then you can do that. And you can explore this Hyrule instead of going to the shrines. And if you did, like me, prefer the dungeons, you can go for as many shrines as you want and let your exploration be limited to just the story markers and what shrines you can find.
Absolutely. And this is really a marked change in direction for Zelda to have so much of the kind of dungeoning content be optional. There isn't, as far as I'm aware, having played for a while, there aren't any dungeons in the game which are completely non-optional, if that makes sense. I think everything is down to you to decide, oh yeah, I want to do this, because doing this will, you know, give me a reward that I want, or achieve something that I want to achieve, or because I find the premise interesting, or whatever. For instance, I don't really like the combat-y shrines very much, so I basically just haven't been doing them. I find them on the map, I they're marked as, combat shrines, and I go, oh, okay, maybe I'll go back to that, eventually, but of course there's so much other stuff to do in the game that I haven't got around to going back through them yet. And I feel that that's maybe part of the essence of what makes this like a kind of very special experience, is that actually if there's something in the game that isn't quite your taste, or even if you would just rather focus on different aspects of the game, you're completely free to do that.
Yeah, I mean, it is completely open in kind of how you approach these things. So, I mean, from my understanding, even like some of the more story-based things that you would think you do have to do, you don't. You can go straight to the end boss, is my understanding in this game.
Yeah.
It's a level of choice that they've never offered you in a Zelda game ever. Even the first one, which this takes a lot of inspiration from, and the second one, Adventure of Link has a lot of things that are, kind of have spiritual successors in this. None of them have allowed you to do that, and it is a lot more like something, Skyrim or whatever, where you could potentially just blast through the story mode and get there as quickly as possible and ignore everything else. It's an interesting new direction for it.
It's a direction I like as well. The fact of, don't get me wrong, I enjoyed the whole story-based thing with the, you're led to a dungeon to do things, but I think having so much freedom to tackle things in any order just adds more to the game than being funneled down a certain path.
I think for me it's just that it's been 20 years since Ocarina of Time introduced that formula. We've had 20 years of Zelda games basically following the template that laid down, and it got to the point where it was so predictable to a point. As much as I love Majora's Mask, Wind Waker, Twilight Princess, not so much Skyward Sword.
Skyward Sword, oh, we know you love it. Don't hide it from us.
As much as those games were great, by the time we kind of got to where we are now, it was like you knew what to expect. You knew at some point you're going to go into a dungeon, you're going to get the hook shot, and it's going to let you go and do this bit, and then you're going to get these arrows, and you're going to get the bombs, and you're going to get this, and you're going to get that. And the kind of beats, you're going to have maybe three dungeons to start with, and then, you're going to have another five to do after that, when something happens in the story, and then you're going to go and fight the main boss. And it all became a bit predictable and a bit staid, and I think that's one of the reasons why A Link Between Worlds was really good, because it took that formula and it twisted it a wee bit, it played about with it, it did say, right, you need to do these dungeons, but you can do them in any order you want, you can get any item you want to start. And I think coming out of that, I was like, well, I don't know what they're going to do for the new game, but they need to do something to shake it up. And then they've just went abandoned the old template, and it's so good to see them do that.
And that's where I think that this, and fair enough, back in the day, I didn't play Ocarina when it came out. I didn't follow it, so I didn't even have that jump from A Link to the Past Ocarina. But looking back, I think that is why the jump to Breath of the Wild is in a way bigger than the jump between A Link to the Past and Ocarina. And I say that because I feel like it's not hard to come to the conclusion that Ocarina is really just A Link to the Past in 3D. There's so very many similarities that it does feel like you're just playing a 3D version of it, whereas Breath of the Wild, compared to any of the Zelda games in the last 20 years, is so radically different that you don't really know what to expect, and you've got your familiar bits like what you've got landmarks in this game that I've been in other games, you've got weapons, but they're given to you and you see them in a different way. So like you said, you go into a dungeon and you'd get the hook shot. In this game, well, we don't know if there's a hook shot. We don't know how you get the hook shot, but it doesn't look like you just go into a dungeon to get it, especially because you can go in any direction after playing it for 10 or so hours. I've not really come across something that made me think, oh, okay, I'll come back here when I've got the hook shot. Whereas in the past, after you played a few Zelda games, you'd know that, okay, I've come to this place, I'll come back with a hookshot, or I'll come back with some bombs. And you don't get that with this, which is why I feel like it's a bigger departure from its predecessors than Ocarina was from A Link to the Past. And that's what makes it stand out so much. Well, one of the reasons, at least.
Mm. Yeah, I mean, it gives you a toolkit at the start in the tutorial area, and then the exploration kind of relies on that toolkit, and there are there are ways to like hopefully without this being a big spoiler, there are ways to like tweak that toolkit as the game progresses. But as far as I know, I'm not like that far into it. But as far as I've seen so far, like the kind of basic premise of the toolkit that you have remains the same. A bit like in Chris was saying, a bit like in A Link Between Worlds, if you kind of just bought up the items at the start and then kind of just went off, you would kind of have access to the game's toolkit and you would be able to use them as you felt fit. And the limiting factor on exploration, rather than having like a kind of progressive unlock of your items but then unlock areas, is more about the difficulty of the areas. There are definitely like areas you want to avoid early on because they're too hard. But of course, there's like an element of like player skill that comes into that as well. So you, I imagine this is one of those games a bit like Dark Souls, where if you replayed it, you would be able to access higher level areas earlier, just because you would be that much better at the game for having played through it all once.
Yeah.
One thing I'll say about a Zelda game that I've never thought of before is with 5 hearts going into an area and getting one shot by something.
Ah, absolutely, yeah. I think that's a fantastic mechanic, because it makes the enemies feel oppressive, right? I can't remember the last time I was actually, kind of wary of enemies in a Zelda game, because with the exception of, like, some of the latter bosses in traditional Zelda games, if you were kind of good at video games, the kind of grunts were never going to do you much harm, they were never going to just completely, basically wreck you. Whereas in this game, they really can. Basically, any enemy has the potential, if you're caught off guard, of you going to the kind of game over screen.
Yeah, no, I would totally agree with that. And kind of going back to what you said when you brought up Dark Souls, I mean, I think this game as a whole, when you kind of look at it, it's the first. It's almost like it's a different Nintendo that's making the game, because they've always existed in their own kind of small bubble, as in we do our own thing, we don't pay attention to what anyone else is doing, and that's how they've always been. They've always just made their own game, their own little bubble, and they just happen to be the best games ever made. Whereas with this, it does feel as if for the very first time they've taken a look at what other people are doing. They've looked at like the Fallouts and the Witchers and the Dark Souls and all these other series, and they've kind of went, okay, people like these kind of things, they like a bit of challenge, and they've taken all these things, put them together, and they've made it their own. I mean, it's like Nintendo have taken the open world game and straight out of the gate they've made the best open world game I've ever played. It's crazy, and it's like I said, it seems to me it's a very, very different Nintendo from what I'm used to. You know, even if down to things like the lack of hand-holding and not having to go through 40 minutes, 45, 50 minutes of tutorials, you know, and how to use my sword, you know, and my shield before I'm let loose in the game. It seems to have a lot more respect for me as a player and a lot more respect for, you know, my time. You know, it's just like, yes, you want to play the game, here's the game, go play it. No, okay, you want to play the game, well, first you need to go through this opening area, you need to go and find this character, and speak to this character who will then give you this, and then tell you to go to that character to do that, and then you need to go and do this silly plot thing, and then the story will kind of start. And before you know it, you've been playing for an hour and a half and nothing of any real interest has happened. Whereas in this an hour and a half, you're well on your way. It's so different, and I love the way they've done it.
As I say, that was a major problem with Twilight Princess. I know some people enjoyed it, some people didn't, but the starting area was like 3 hours long or something before you actually got into the meat of the game.
Yeah, if you've not played Twilight Princess before, then yeah, it can take you an hour or two to get past the kind of initial sections of it, yeah.
So, I think it's become quite obvious that we all really love this game, and we think that very high praise towards it is very much deserved. In fact, I don't think any of us have said anything kind of negative about it yet. So, for the sake of like playing Devil's Advocate, I noticed that I think earlier today, Jim Sterling of the Jimquisition. Free advertising from there amongst our kind of dozen viewers. he gave this a 7 out of 10, and he had some like very negative things to say about it. So I was just going to raise some of these points, and I was interested to hear you guys, as you know, people who are really enjoying this, kind of what you thought of some of the points that he's made.
Yeah, Dama.
So the first kind of little bit that I wanted to kind of read out. As he said, it's an odd decision to constantly break immersion and flow by halting the player and giving them another weird little puzzle bunker that seems like it doesn't quite belong in this world.
Is he talking about shrines?
He's talking about the shrines there, and well, he thinks that they don't belong and that they're weird and that they break the flow.
What? What nonsense is this? That the shrines have a perfect fitting in the world. They actually make sense. Ugh, I hate people.
as I said earlier, having shrines scattered around the world is one of the things that makes this so enjoyable because it means that I can explore, but then I'll still get one of, if not the best bit of Zelda games, in that I'll have a little puzzle to solve without having to delve into a dungeon that will then take me about an hour or so to complete. So I can nip in, solve a puzzle, go to a different shrine, solve another puzzle, until I'm happy and I decide that I want to explore the world and maybe look for new locations or find some NPCs. And as Ped said, they do actually fit into the world, not just because of what the game is trying to do, which is literally have these scattered runs so you do explore and it gives you more of a reason to explore, but also there is a story element behind it which should click as you play the game, discover the story and piece together what they are and how they fit into it.
Yeah, I mean, we haven't been discussing the story that much because of our kind of promise to be vague and not too spoilery, but kind of your viewers should know that this game, you know, despite being very open world and very like choose your own path, there's tons of story there if you want to experience it. You know, lots of NPCs, lots of, you know, backstory conversations you can have that fill you in about like the history of kind of what's gone wrong in this world and what you're kind of trying to correct and kind of giving you reasons to kind of want to save this world. And definitely there's like, you know, in this kind of, you know, rich story that it builds up, there's definitely like justifications for like the shrines being there. So I don't feel that they like don't belong in the world. I feel like quite the opposite. Like I've never questioned the shrines, they seem to make perfect sense from both like a mechanical and like a story perspective to me.
Yeah, I mean, I'm the same. I don't quite see what he's going for there. Also, I mean, but he says it constantly break immersion and flow by halting the player and giving me another puzzle bunker. Well, it doesn't though. Not for me. I mean, it's when I see one, it's not like, oh right, great. It doesn't seem like a chore to distract me from what I'm supposed to do. And it's another kind of, oh, there's a shrine, brilliant. I can go and, you know, get another thing. Can't remember what they're called. So yeah, I mean, it's I don't quite get where he's coming from with that. No, don't get
it. It's like complaining about collectibles in games, something you can do extra, or some complaining about having side missions in games. Oh, look, it's distracting me from the main game. It's like, no, it's there for in addition. You can do it or not. It's up to you. It won't break your immersion and it's part of the world. It makes sense.
So Jim goes on to say that, you know, he understands that they're like technically optional, but he doesn't feel that they're optional, because of some of the upgrades that you get from them being useful. But I think people have already completed the game in speedruns or whatever without doing any of the shrines. So, I mean, I think it's kind of factually incorrect to kind of call them optional dash not dash optional, if that makes sense. You know, because it's, they are optional. You only do them if you want to, and you kind of should want to because they're really good, but if for some reason you don't, then you don't have to, you know.
Well, I would disagree with you there, Carol. I mean, I would kind of say that I wouldn't think that they're optional. Yeah, you can turn around and say, oh, well, the speedrunners can do it without them, but let's face it, speedrunners are not the same as us mere mortals. They are always able to do insane, crazy stuff with their games. I think there is the shrines are needed, basically, to an extent. You have to do them if you want to have anywhere near enough hearts and stamina to progress through the game. And yes, technically they are optional. You can do it without doing any of them. Beyond the first four. But I think only the most dedicated and insane players will be doing that.
Yeah, I mean, I would kind of like broadly agree in that, you know, I feel like the game clearly intends for you to be doing most of the shrines that like you happen to come across. But I mean, I don't think that you need to make doing shrines your focus if you don't want to. I think that there's obviously like a minimum that you should be doing to like get enough hearts, basically, to do the bosses that you come across. But I mean, you can achieve a lot through cooking, which is like a mechanic we haven't really talked that much about yet. You can put together absolutely insane dinners that give you such huge bonuses to your hearts and your defense that I don't think you need to always be thinking, oh, you know, I need to like do every shrine, even though I don't really want to, because if, you know, my character won't be optimal if I don't. I think it's a bit like taking like Dark Souls as like an analogy. Like, obviously, like it helps to have like a really optimized build for your character. But like, you can play Dark Souls pretty reasonably with like a kind of suboptimal build if there are like different mechanics that you want to try out. You know, if you want to mix, you know, all of the different kinds of magic, you can still like complete the game. Obviously, like there's like another level to it, which is like playing through the whole game as like a level one deprived, which obviously like only the really hardcore speedrunners can do, and that's fair enough. Like, you know, I wouldn't say to a Dark Souls player, well, you don't have to level up. That's completely optional. But you don't like have to level up along like a set path if you don't want to. And I think that's kind of like the analogy I would draw. So another point that he raised is, you know, we were just talking about Dark Souls, and he said that rather than fully mimic the Dark Souls combat it half-heartedly aims for, really scaling stuff here, Breath of the Wild just pumps up the monster's ability to do damage, resulting in like a lot of one-hit kills. He says that that's like a cheap way of making the game difficult.
Now, that I completely disagree with, because while some monsters are very powerful and can destroy you in one hit, you can mitigate that by, as we said, cooking and increasing your defenses or your heart count. You can wear stronger armor, you can dodge, but also that's not the only way that the enemies are lethal. You'll find, and not really that late on, quite early on in the game, that the enemies have brains, and you just need to find two of them before you're in a situation where one will try to flank you, and you need to be aware of your surroundings. You need to remember that you saw two enemies, and if your focus is now on one and the other one's not on your screen, you need to find it before it stabs you from the side or the back, because it's almost certainly going to do that. So no, these enemies aren't cheap because they're ridiculously powerful, and they're not difficult in that way. They're difficult in that way to an extent, but not completely, and they actually are clever. And this is where they do become like Dark Souls enemies. Those enemies aren't stupid, and really neither are these. They will use their advantages, and another way they do this is with the weapons they have. So you'll find some enemies have spears, some have swords, and the spear enemies will poke you, and if you've got a sword, they'll poke you, and that'll give you damage, and that'll probably kill you. So unless you're aware of that, you'll literally be poked to death, and you need to think, okay, this guy has a spear, I've got a sword, he will outreach me, I need to maybe shoot him with an arrow or throw my sword at him and pick up a different one so to stun him. But you need to really think about how you're fighting. So no, they're not cheap, or what did he say?
Yeah, he basically called it like a cheap way of adding difficulty. He said it's like a half-hearted imitation of Dark Souls combat.
I totally do not agree with that. It's not cheap, and it's not a half-hearted imitation. It takes the concept of tough enemies from Dark Souls, and it makes it its own by putting it into this game, and it doesn't feel like, oh, okay, this is out of place, this should be more of a Dark Souls kind of thing. It's, oh wow, this reminds me of Dark Souls, but it totally fits in this game, this Zelda game. It's an evolution or an homage to Dark Souls.
I'm not being funny, but when you criticize a game for having enemies that can one-shot you by just being tougher, and then citing Dark Souls as a game that doesn't do this, and there's better combat because of it, when I've plenty of time plays a Dark Souls game and be one-shot by something, I think that's kind of stupid and bullshit. To be completely honest. Yeah, Dark Souls is nowhere near as good as people make out.
Lies. Heresy.
Oh dear.
Really isn't.
Well, I mean, whatever you think of the overall quality of Dark Souls, I mean, both Dark Souls and Breath of the Wild, I think, are games where you have to know what enemies are capable of, and you have to like approach them intelligently, or you'll very quickly be overwhelmed. And I mean, from my perspective, I don't really know what Jim wanted from the new Zelda, because I think it's extracted that system actually very well. I can't see a way that the Zelda could have like incorporated those mechanics better. I mean, it has the kind of dodge mechanics from Dark Souls, but it's again, it's made its own. But the core mechanics of dodging and parrying are both there. And you can look at an enemy once you're experienced enough, and you can know how it's going to attack you. And there are like attack patterns that make fights easier if you're aware of them. And there are ways to like draw aggro, and there are ways to do crowd management, and there are ways to like kind of cheese enemies a bit with certain abilities, or by moving outside of their like home range so that they kind of get bored and go home, and then you can stab at them again, then run away.
At least one thing that you can do in Dark Souls that you can't do in the first Dark Souls, that you can't do in Zelda, is get a knight to chase you, shut a door on it, and then stab you through the door to death. Because you can't do that in Zelda.
Yeah, I guess you can't do that in Zelda. That's true. But you know, most of the cheesing mechanics are kind of there if you look for them. So, and I think that's the kind of like game in combat that it wants to be. I mean, it's not about running into the middle of a group of enemies and then doing, I don't know, a spin attack like you would in Ocarina of Time or whatever, and then that's it. You know, room cleared. It requires a little bit more thought, and it's taken that mechanic from more modern action adventure games. I think it's done really well. So the third and final point from the review I was interested in hearing your thoughts on He says, weapon durability systems are never fun, and Zelda goes out of its way to make it as excruciating as it possibly can. This has like three paragraphs in his review. He really goes to town. He really hates the weapon durability system. Have you guys had like a problem with it? Do you think it's good? Bad?
I haven't got a problem with it. It's not the most ideal system in the world, admittedly, because when you want a weapon, you don't really want it to break. But you guess the game is so scattered with weapons. Once you lose one, you tend to pick up another one not long later from either another enemy or one that's laying in the floor. And the best thing about it is it adds some variety to your gameplay, to the mechanics of your fighting, because when you're using a shield, a one-handed sword and a shield, it's different to using a two-handed sword, and it's different to using a spear or a club. So it's good in that respect, but you know, I can't understand the criticisms of it because it isn't the most ideal system for you to just go and explore and then chop people down, like, you know?
I think for me, it's a bit of a double-edged sword, if you excuse the pun. You've got, on the one hand, yes, it encourages you to pick up other weapons and try different styles and lots of other things, which is kind of cool because, I mean, you get to try lots of different things. But on the other hand, especially early on in the game when your inventory space for weapons is so small, it really does... I find it discourages me from using some of the weapons I've got. Because, I've got a couple of weapons that I think are really cool that, you know, I've got for finishing quests and a couple of other pieces, and I don't want to use them because I don't want to break them. And it gets to the point where there's, you know, certain times where I just did a boss fight earlier on today, and it's in a couple of weapons that I've been carrying about for ages because I've not wanted to use them, finally had some use. But for most of the good weapons I get, it's just a case of, well, I'm going to leave you until I can find something better, and then I'll start using the kind of mid-range weapons I've got. It's a double-edged sword, and it kind of cuts both ways. On the one hand, it's good variety, but on the other hand, I think it does discourage you from using certain weapons for fear of losing them.
Yeah, I can understand that. Like myself, when I've got like a load of different weapons, I'll literally use my weakest weapon to go around to fight normal enemies because I don't want my most powerful weapon breaking against a Bokoblin. So I would save that for then a tougher fight where the item, if it breaks something difficult, it doesn't feel like a waste.
Yeah,
I can see your points there, and I'm also kind of tiering my weapons, so I'll use the weaker ones unless I feel like I've come across an enemy that would benefit from being, or where I'll benefit from using a strong weapon. But the weapons system, and I'm not gonna compare the game to Dark Souls unnecessarily, but I'm gonna compare it once more. The weapon system reminds me of Dark Souls in that you need to be clever about your resources. So in Dark Souls, you had a finite number of Estus, and unless you went back to a bonfire and rested there, which would then respawn all the enemies, so you really had to, you couldn't really cheese that most of the time. You had to be clever with your use or just get better at fighting, so you didn't need to use as much Estus. And in Breath of the Wild, you need to be clever about how you use your weapon. So your main way is to just actually use it to attack the enemies, but then you, if you're fighting well, for example, if you get a clear indication that your weapon's about to break, so you can get a couple of extra hits in, but maybe you just do one or two, and then before it breaks, you throw it at the enemy's head to try to get a critical hit, and then bang, you kill the enemy and break the weapon, but then you pick up the other enemy's weapon. Or alternatively, you thrash an enemy so hard that it drops its weapon, you grab its weapon, and bang, you've disarmed that enemy, you haven't broken your weapon, now you've got another weapon. So really, it just gives you another way to play cleverly. So I feel that it's not a big problem in that you'll really ever run out of weapons unless you really just aren't learning to adapt to the way this game is set up. But then, trying to save weapons is a real, can be a real concern. But I feel like it's a justified trade-off.
I think for me, there's a couple of ways that it could be done maybe slightly better. I mean, maybe it could be that the weapon doesn't break, but it gets blunt, or it, you know, becomes dull, so it does little to no damage. and you've then got the ability to maybe go off and sharpen it or something to fix it or repair them properly. And I know there are a couple of weapons that you can repair, which I think that would go some way to mitigate it. One thing, and maybe this turns up later on, but I haven't noticed it yet, would be the ability to store weapons somewhere. You know, get, because I mean, I get all these really nice weapons and things like that. Maybe aren't, you know, I want to keep a hold of, but you know, aren't maybe going to be the most practical for where I'm going. And so I'd like, it'd be nice if I had somewhere I could go and store those weapons. You know, like I said, maybe that turns up later on in the game, but so far I've not noticed anything like that. But that would be good. That's, those are my main issues with it. But even then, it's once you get past the initial kind of sections and you start to expand your inventory space for your weapons, then it becomes less of a problem because you can carry more. But certainly in the early sections, it was a little bit annoying. You know, especially when you're still learning what enemies, you know, you can kind of get away with attacking and not being completely, you know, wiped out by it.
What's your thoughts, Carl? Because you haven't really said anything about it.
I feel like it does discourage you from using certain weapons. I was about to reply to Cheeky and say, without giving away the kind of nature or extent of it, I have noticed a way to access a kind of storage eventually. It's not actually something that I'm able to access yet, but it's something that I think by the end of the game you'll be able to access. I'm not sure on exactly the details or the form it will take yet. But I think there's a system like that in the game. Like I say, I haven't myself been able to access the kind of details of that yet. But hopefully, I mean, I can see why it's like a kind of high level system, because I guess by the end of the game you'll have lots of high level weapons. Maybe you'll need a place to put them. I don't know. So there's a little bit of speculation on my part there. You know, I hope you don't take that as a big spoiler or whatever. But
no, that's good.
I was going to say that yes, I find that about 3/4 of my weapons in the inventory at the moment is like kind of high level weapons I don't really want to use, because I'm always thinking like, oh, you know, like what if there's like an even bigger, badder enemy around the corner? So I completely sympathize with why systems like this can feel discouraging. But then I've been making a conscious effort to try and look at it this way. I mean, my inventory is basically full of these like really cool weapons, and I find other really cool weapons all the time. So why not kind of use them, right? I mean, at certain points it's gotten to a point where like I can't pick up a good weapon because I would have to drop another good weapon. And at that stage I was kind of thinking to myself, well, I should probably just use them, right? And I think that's kind of what the game is encouraging you to do. I don't think the game is intending for Link to be like a hoarder of these like cool things that he finds. I think the you know, team behind the game or whatever will have intended you to kind of, you know, pick up a weapon and use it, and get into a kind of loop where you're always like using the cool new thing that you find basically straight away. You know, with an exception of maybe, you know, if you get your really, you know, god tier weapons, maybe you would put that to one side for like a boss. But I think most of the cool stuff you find, you're supposed to kind of just get out there and use. So
yeah,
over the last like hour or so of playing, I think I've been making more of a conscious effort to just use the cool stuff that I find and not stress so much about, oh, what, you know, what if I'm wasting something cool. So I mean, for me, I think this touches on like a slightly deeper issue with open world games, in that you're expected to know what you find fun and then actively pursue the things that you find fun, because the game isn't leading you to do any one particular thing. And I think that's true of this like weapon inventory system as well. I mean, hoarding weapons and like not using them and stressing about when to use them isn't fun. So I think you have to trust the game to enable you to have fun by supplying you with more weapons. So you should just do the fun thing. You know, if you have like a really high level, I don't know, fire sword or whatever, and using it would be fun, then just use it and have fun. And you've got to trust that the game will give you, you know, another cool sword to play with, you know, in a bit. But I think that's like an issue with like open world games, is that yeah, you have to decide almost consciously like what the fun elements are, and then you have to pursue them and then trust the game to continue to provide you with those elements.
Okay, so now we've gone over what we like. We've looked at some dissenting opinions and given our thoughts on why we mainly disagree with those. Let's now look at how we're playing the game, because it's on the Switch and we're playing it on the Switch, but it's also on the Wii U. So let's talk about how we're playing it and what we think of each of the methods. Now I started out with the Wii Remote mode, with the Joy-Con in each hand, and that's quite comfortable in that it lets me, it means that my arms are free, so I can pretty much sit however I want, and I've got just as much control of the game as I would in any other situation. And the little pieces of plastic you add to the Joy-Con to make it a bit bigger do help a lot, in that you get a better grip on the Joy-Cons, but they're still maneuverable enough to hold in your hands without really feeling like you're weighed down or you can't hold it comfortably. I then do from time to time put it into the grip, the dock grip you get. In fact, the Joy-Cons are currently sitting in that because sometimes that extra stability does help, particularly with some of the motion control puzzles. And this is quite comfortable. I was surprised that so many people, that I was not expecting it to be this comfortable when I tried it, because of how people say that, how I've read online that the Pro controllers, some people feel necessary because this doesn't really work. But for me, I find this very comfortable, and it makes me think, you know, the Pro controller must be something godlike, because I happily continue with this. In fact, if my Pro controller hadn't been delivered, I probably wouldn't order one. And I've also played it in handheld mode, like a Vita, in bed. That, I'd say, is the least comfortable, purely because it does feel kind of heavy having it all together. So when I'm lying back, it's not as like holding up in the air a bit to see does kind of strain my arms a bit if I'm playing for a long time. Whereas with the 3DS, I could have that resting on my chest and just look at the top screen. But it's still, you know, I can still play for a while with it. So how have you been playing this wonderful game?
I've mostly been using it with the grip when I've got it on my TV. And then if I'm got it on the move, then also the handheld kind of configuration. And I've had absolutely no problems with it at all. The grip for me is perfectly fine. You know, I can access everything easily enough. Perfectly comfortable. And even for the handheld kind of mode, the longest I've kind of played it, and that's probably been about 40 minutes, this is part of my train journey. And yeah, I mean, that's fine. That's, you know, I've not had any issues with it at all. Yeah, if you're holding it up in front of you all the time, your arms get a little bit tired. But for me, I tend to hold it just a little bit lower anyway, so that's perfectly fine. The only issue I have is, you know, when somebody's sitting next to you and you're like, can I get your arms out? It's like, get them away, probably. But yeah, no, I think it's been great so far. Really, really enjoying it. I've not tried the Pro Controller. Don't have any real inclination to get one at any point. Because I was one of these people who got in perfectly fine with the base Wii U controller. I didn't feel the need to get, you know, the Pro Controller for that. And I don't see me getting it for this either, unless, you know, somebody comes out and tells me, you know, an amazing reason to get one, because I'm having absolutely no trouble with the Joy-Cons as it is.
Yeah, so same for me. I'm 100% happy with the Joy-Cons. I don't have a TV at home, so I've exclusively been playing my Switch with the Joy-Cons kind of plugged into it, basically like a Game Boy or a PS Vita or whatever. And yeah, I've had no problems. I guess the system is like maybe, it certainly feels like maybe a little bit weightier than, say, a 3DS, but I mean, yeah, it seemed like comfortable to me. I've had like no problems, like, you know, using the controls. I like sometimes in like really intense moments of combat, I accidentally click in the left stick and like crouch, which is like kind of irritating, but it's just like my own incompetence. I don't think, you know, that's not like, I would probably do that on the Pro Controller as well, so I don't feel that I would have anything to like gain from getting the Pro Controller. I've been really really impressed with how good the Joy-Cons feel to use, actually. I haven't been sat here thinking, oh, I wish I had a proper controller. It's actually felt really, really good to me.
I'll say this much. When you mentioned that you don't have a TV, it's worth trying to prop up the Switch on its stand and detaching the Joy-Cons just to see how they feel, even if it's just in the grip, because I did do that sometimes. I did do that a couple of times from bed, so I've got the Switch on my table with the kickstand open, and I'm using the Joy-Cons, one in each hand, just to play it. And it works well. I'm not too far from the Switch, so the small screen size isn't much of an issue. And this is kind of how I plan to play it at work, in that I'm going to set up the Switch on the table and have the Joy-Cons out, just because I'll be using it in handheld mode on the train, and this will kind of mix it up and give me some more time to figure out how I definitely do prefer to play the Switch. But yeah, you can definitely try that out if you want to see how the Joy-Cons work on their own. Away from the Switch, whether it's on their own or in the grip.
Mm. Yeah, I guess I was like, probably the reason I didn't try it, to be honest, I didn't really think much of it, but I think like subconsciously maybe I was probably thinking like, oh, you know, the text size might be a little bit small if I had it like kind of on a table and I was like sat back, you know, or whatever. But you know, I'll probably give it a go at some point. Like, yeah, I think it would work better at a desk where you could be like quite close to it. But I guess if I was like on a sofa, like sitting back, and then it was on like a kind of a living room table, it might feel like kind of slightly far away, like because some of the text can be not like small if you're holding it, you know, close. But I mean, it is a much smaller screen than the television, obviously.
So, Peds, how do you play yours?
Well, unlike you lot, I use the Pro Controller for my Zelda. It is such a comfortable controller. It is easily one of the nicest controllers I've ever put in my hands. It just feels so sexy and sturdy. The Joy-Cons, I did try them in the grip. And I thought they were okay, but they're a bit narrow. So the Pro Controller is, in my opinion, a lot more comfortable to hold. The only time I've played the system in handheld mode is when I played Blaster Master Zero, because I've been streaming Zelda. Whenever I play it, it's obviously connected to the TV so I can stream. Otherwise, I probably would have played more of it by now than I have done, because I would have played it handheld. Get a Pro Controller. My Joy-Con, I got to switch between the two, because I've got 4 Joy-Con. So I got to switch every so often to charge both up, pays up, like. I got it with the Snipper Clips bundle.
Yeah, I got that too. I haven't opened it.
It's a good game, Snipper Clips, but it does get challenging by the third set of levels. Some of them are a little tricky.
Are you playing on your own or with someone?
With my missus.
Is it fun? Can you see it being fun on your own, or is it definitely something to play with someone?
I can see it being enjoyable on its own. But it's like Overcooked, you can play that on your own, but it's so much better with someone, because you can have such a good laugh, as well as like you can then discuss things about how you can do things to really sort out your puzzles and things like that. So yeah, I would definitely recommend it as a co-op game before single player game.
Yeah,
okay, I
would agree with that. I played it with the missus a wee bit, and it's good fun. It's a good simple co-op puzzler, and I can't see it anywhere near as enjoyable in single player.
I'd definitely save that then for a multiplayer when I get the chance, hopefully next week.
Yeah, definitely.
Okay, so before we go back into other games we might have played, let's go a bit deeper into the hardware itself. So we've looked at the controllers, and one thing I noticed when I picked it up for the first time, it's lighter than I expected. Which is ironic, given that when I'm lying back in bed, I find it heavy. But that's because I'm literally holding up in there for God knows how long. The actual device is lighter than I expected. I haven't had any trouble yet with the dock in terms of scratching or anything. It did take me a while to figure out why I couldn't get a picture on my TV, and it turned out I hadn't plugged the damn thing into the power socket, into a power outlet. So, you know,
brilliant.
Watch out for that when you set yours up.
Pro tip that. Plug it in.
So what do you guys have, what were your thoughts on the actual device itself, you know, the console, the screen and the parts behind it?
me personally, I would say that it's a nice handheld console, but to me, I would have rather had a home console only, because portable mode is literally going to be, like, I have used it for Blastmaster Zero just to use in handheld mode, but it's never going to be taken out of the house, so it's never going to be used portably. But it's a good console in itself. Like, it's sturdy, it's well made, there's no scratches on it, you know? It's just, yeah.
So I'm kind of like the anti-Pete here, because I only use it in handheld mode, and I have taken it out of the house. So I would have been really screwed over if it were like just a home console. Basically, the reason I like basically got the Switch was because I would be able to use it as a portable. I think it's a great idea that it's a hybrid. It's giving like people more options to engage with those games how they want to, and not being locked into like one kind of hardware paradigm, I guess. I think it's a great idea, and it's enabled me to engage with Zelda without, you know, having to buy a TV, basically. So I'm really pleased about that. And as for the actual hardware itself, I mean, it feels really solid. It feels like a premium piece of hardware compared to any other like portable console that I've seen or used. You know, compared to the Vita, compared to even the like new 3DS, which I thought at the time the new 3DS seemed pretty premium itself. But I mean, this just it just looks very impressive. It feels really solid to hold. It just seems like really high build quality. I don't see how anyone could have an issue with this, with like the quality of the hardware at all.
Yeah, I mean, I was kind of the middle ground between the two of you, Peds, who never takes it out of the house, and obviously yourself, Carl, who's kind of only takes it out of the house, you know, doesn't use it on the TV. I mean, even right up to the unveiling of this, I was very sceptical of the whole hybrid thing, and because I do most of my gaming at home, and I was just like, you know, I've got a 3DS and I barely play it. So I wasn't, you know, all the rumours going about, I really wasn't looking forward to it. I was just like, I'd much rather just have a powerful home system rather than this. But when the reveal came along and then they showed it all off, you know, it kind of got me on board with it. And now that I've got it, it's absolutely stunning. I love it. The build quality seems really, really nice. It feels good in your hand. It's got a nice weight to it. It looks good. Everyone that I've shown it to, everyone that's had a shot of it so far, seems really, really kind of enamoured by it. And even people who, you know, like my brother-in-law and a couple of my mates who maybe don't traditionally buy Nintendo consoles are kind of going, well, all right, that's actually quite good. You know, partially for Zelda, because, you know, Zelda beat Zelda. But it looks like a nice bit of kit, feels like a nice bit of kit. And I think it's going to see me playing more games on the go, basically. I mean, I've spent all week playing Zelda on the train and on my lunch break. And I think it's partly because it lets me play these big home console feeling games on the go, whereas previous handheld games that I've never thought of always felt as if they're almost like stripped back versions of games I'd rather play on a TV, whereas now it's like I can take those full games anywhere. I'm really impressed by it, and I think it looks really good. Like I said, and, you know, I've got I think I kind of went all out actually with the launch. I got the machine, 6 games, and another set of Joy-Cons, so I'm definitely on this for the long haul.
That last point about taking home console games on the go and like actual home console games, not a kind of watered down version like you may get on other devices, is what sold the Switch to me when it was first revealed. I take my 3DS to work, and I still do. I'm just going to wrap up the last few games before I put the Switch into rotation. So I take it to work and play on, you know, like you said, or on the train and during lunch. But when I got home, I'd always feel like, well, I want to continue that game to make more progress, but then I'm home, I feel like I should take advantage of having a bigger screen and more powerful hardware. And this is where the Switch is pretty much perfect. I can play on handheld mode when I'm outside the house and then dock it and have it kind of overclock itself and use the extra fan in the dock to cool it down, so it's showing something more on the TV. So I actually am making use of being at home where I can get something more powerful going and have it running on a bigger screen. So that concept just immediately sold the device to me, and knowing that I'd be able to continue my game wherever I am was just a great idea. And so Zelda is just the best example of that. In the future I will just literally just gonna stop playing at night, and the next morning I'll continue just where I was on the train and right through the rest of the day whenever I can.
Yeah, I think that's a good point as well, actually. Just how quick it is to go from you're playing on the TV to you're playing it in the handheld to put into sleep mode to turn it back on and being back in the game. It's so fast. I mean, literally, it takes me longer to get it out of my bag than it does to turn it on and get back into the game. It's so quick at doing it, and it's really impressive, and it means that, you know, I don't have to bring it out, load the game up, load up my save, and then, you know, go right, where was I? Picked it back on, it's, oh yeah, I was doing this, and then that's me. The only downside I've found to it so far is that there was times where I would be doing something in the handheld mode and I would be like, I'd rather see this on the telly. So, for example, obviously in Zelda, you've got the memories that you can find or unlock to get, you know, some of the backstory filled in. There was a time where I found one of the memories and I'm sitting watching it in my handheld. And it still looks fantastic. The screen's really, really nice. But at the same time, I'm thinking, man, I kind of prefer to watch this on the bigger screen. So that's the only downside that I can find so far.
It's kind of tangential, but you mentioned there the like speed of like bringing it out of sleep mode and like jumping back into games and how it seems to like hold like the state of a game in its memory and you know just bring it back really quickly. And I think like that's some like excellent like software design there from Nintendo. I think previous consoles have had like operating systems which felt, you know, maybe a little bit clunky, like the 3DS, I don't know, like it's certainly like it was okay, but like the OS was like, it was kind of, it could feel a little bit cluttered at times on like the home screen, and it wasn't like, it certainly like wasn't as responsive as like the Switch is.
Yeah,
the Switch just has like a really nice feeling OS, which is like, it has like a very like simple like minimalist layout, but you can still like access everything like really quickly that you want to do, and this like sleep system where you can go in and out of games on the home screen just literally instantly. It takes like, you know, less than a second. I just think it's really intelligent OS design. I've really appreciated seeing that.
Yeah, I think that's actually been a theme, I think, of the whole generation, not just on this. I mean, the PS4 and presumably the Xbox One are the same. I think it's partially to do with, you know, the more memory that they've got available for the OS. Because so I think if you go back to, you know, the PS3, you know, 3DS, 360 as well towards the end, and let's not forget the Wii U when it first launched, just how slow and sluggish those systems are in comparison. I mean, you remember how long it took to get back to the home menu in the Wii U at launch? You'd press the home button and it'd take sometimes up to a minute before you were back to it. It was really, really poor. Whereas with this, I think it's like you said, it's much, much better design software. Plus, I think it's also the extra memory and resources that they're now able to allocate to simple things like, you know, running the menu system behind the actual game.
I definitely would just also agree that the OS is very slick and a big leap forward from both the Wii U and the 3DS, and this just helps sell the Switch's unique point of playing anywhere, in that you can get back into your game literally in seconds. I mean, just earlier today I switched it on and found I was in the village talking to someone, and literally right there, no loading screen, no title logo, just bang, right there in the middle of that conversation I was in the middle of when I sent it to sleep a few hours earlier. It's incredible. It's just the little things like that which really cement this as a great idea, and why I'm very happy with this hybrid of a home console and handheld, and I'm excited for pretty much every game to come out. I mean, historically I'd actually get, you know, if given the choice, I'd go for the PC version of the game, but now I find myself thinking, or at least waiting to see how a game will run on the Switch before deciding if it's running at a good enough quality, preferably 60 frames a second, and this is kind of why I'm not going to get I Am Setsuna on the Switch. But if it's a good port, then I'll probably go for the Switch version over the Steam version, just because I'll be able to play it anywhere, and I'm more likely to finish it and play it because it's so much more accessible on the Switch than on my PC.
So we've all been really positive about both the Switch and Zelda. You know, they're certainly not like, you know, they're not perfect. Nothing is, but I think, you know, it's been, you know, I mean, Zelda's like a clear 10 out of 10 game for all of us, and the Switch is like really promising from certainly from like a hardware perspective. Shenka, I think like there are a few things you were like looking forward to. So why don't you tell us about kind of what you're looking forward to for the Switch over the next kind of, you know, 9 months or so?
I mean, just over the next couple of months, I'm already looking forward to, well, actually, even from launch, a lot of my time has been, well, all my Switch time has been taken up by Zelda, but I've got Snipper Clips ready to play. I want to check out 1-2 Switch in multiplayer, because it actually does look like fun with other people. But then looking to the rest of this month, and next month, even though I've played over 300 hours of it on the Wii U, I'm still very excited for Mario Kart 8 Deluxe, because it will bring such a fantastic game to a whole new user base, because it's all well on the Wii U, but I'm sure that it does feel like a lot of people who bought the Switch didn't buy a Wii U or didn't have one, and so for them it's a brand new game, and this will help give it a new install base. I'm looking forward to ARMS, because Wii Boxing was one of my favorite games on the Wii. I really liked that it came back on the Wii U with an improved control scheme where you could use two Wii remotes. And this seems like a great evolution of that, so I'm really looking forward to using the Joy-Cons and the motion controllers to fight other people once again. Soon after that, I mean, Puyo Puyo Tetris is already out in Japan. I was going to buy the Japanese version when I got my Switch, but I've been so busy with Zelda, I haven't even bought that yet. So it might be that I just wait for the EU release. But you know, I've loved Tetris since Tetris was one of the first games I ever played. So I'm really excited to get that, because it's a whole new kind of twist on that classic game. Splatoon 2, I was actually playing the original this weekend as kind of a little break from Zelda, and it's still really enjoyable, so I'm looking forward to see the new additions to this. And don't actually forget, in 2 weeks is the test fire for Splatoon 2, so you can trial that game not next weekend, but the weekend after that, so I'm looking forward to that. Xenoblade Chronicles 2, the original, is one of my favorite games and really reinvigorated my enjoyment of JRPGs, so I'm really excited to get back into that. I really enjoyed Hyrule Warriors, and Fire Emblem is one of my favorite series, so Fire Emblem Warriors is high on my list of games. And there's this Super Mario game called Odyssey that looks okay, you know, that might be fun to play.
I don't know, I mean, the kind of previous Mario games haven't been that great, so I'm not actually really excited about Odyssey.
Yeah, I mean, 64, Galaxy, 3D World, they're kind of like forgettable. But you know, it's something for Christmas. It could be fun.
Yeah, I look forward to Jim Sterling's 6 out of 10 for Mario Odyssey.
Thoroughly deserved. How about you guys? We've all got Switches here. What's on your list? What are you looking forward to after Zelda, if you can believe that there will be such time?
Well, I think for me, there's a couple. There's ones you mentioned. There's ARMS. There's Splatoon 2. Later on, I've got Mario. In between that is kind of more of the smaller titles I'm looking at. I can't remember them off the top of my head, but certainly, you know, some of the indie games coming forward look really, really good. Specifically, Wargroove, which is just like it's the Advance Wars game that Nintendo would give us. So I will take that instead. And it looks really, really good. It just looks like more Advance Wars, which is all I want. Thank you very much.
Wasn't there a different time period though? To wasn't like tanks and stuff. It was older.
It's medieval Advance Wars. I don't think it's feudal China because it's medieval.
I can't remember. I remember like a clip of it from the thing, but I can't. I couldn't place in my head when it was because I can't remember. So
yeah, it's like knights and dragons and stuff, but it's still got, it's the Advanced Wars gameplay basically.
Yeah, yeah.
Because when that trailer came on for that direct, I was waiting for it to turn into fucking Fire Emblem, and it's like, God, it didn't. I'm so sick to the IT for Fire Emblem. Although I will say that Fire Emblem Warriors is probably going to be on there as well, because I like Hyrule Warriors, so I'm open to see what they do with that. There were a couple of other things as well, I can't remember off the top of my head. Mario Kart, I still haven't decided on that one. To be honest, I'm probably going to buy it, but I don't know, we'll see. I'll maybe trade in my Wii U version just to get something back for it at least. But there's enough to keep me interested. And there are more games other than what I said, I just can't remember off the top of my head. But there's plenty coming out on like PS4 and, you know, other things to fill in any gaps that I might have. Of what I will say before we kind of finish up is that obviously Horizon Zero Dawn came out like 2 or 3 days before Zelda. That game is not going to get a look at for months, frankly, until Zelda's done, because I'm not sure I can really go to big open world games back to back, and especially when, you know, it's coming after Zelda for me. It's going to be tough to follow that.
There's three games that I'm not sure if all will make it this year, but there's three games I'm really looking forward to. Splatoon 2, which I can't see being delayed. I really enjoyed Splatoon, playing it with you guys on a Wednesday night. It was great. It's a shame that it kind of died off, but I'm hoping with Splatoon 2 we'll get a resurgence in people playing it. We'll go back to having a Wednesday night of Splatoon fun times. The other game, which hopefully won't be delayed at all, is Mario Odyssey. I've enjoyed the Mario 3D games, 3D Mario games. Probably not quite as much as I enjoyed like Super Mario World, Super Mario Brothers 3, because I think nostalgia probably plays a big part of that. But another game in the vein of Sunshine and 64 is going to be spectacular. And the other game, which I can see being pushed to 2018, is Xenoblade Chronicles 2. Now, that is a game I want to play. I fucking love Xenoblade Chronicles, and more is just like, I haven't started X, which I need to get around to, but I just want it. And if it carries on from the end of the first game, somehow, you know, then that'll be great. I need more. I want it in my veins, man.
Going back to the indies that Chris mentioned, they remind me of a couple that I really liked when I saw them. One, Mr. Shifty, the kind of sneaky top-down game where it's like Metal Gear Solid, I guess, in that you're sneaking around trying to, I don't know what the hell you're trying to do, but it's pretty shit. It's pretty sneaky. It looks fun. Snake Pass, this very strange kind of, I want to say platformer.
Ooh,
but
yes,
that looks good. Yeah.
It's as much of a, ukulele, without, you know, goes without saying.
Charles Game of the Year.
But that I'm probably going to get on PC because I can't change my Kickstarter thing. Celeste is a 2D platformer that looks pretty tricky but rewarding. I think those are the ones that really stuck out to me. Well, at least that I can. Also, Has Been Heroes. It's by the people who made Trine. It looks fun. I will say I'm kind of confused that these developers said that they ran out of money to finish Trine 3, but then this is like the third game that's come out since then. But that's probably for another. That's another topic. But yeah, there's quite a few games coming out this year. And again, these ones that I've just mentioned, almost certainly coming to Steam as well, but because of how accessible the Switch is, I'm probably just going to buy them for the Switch instead.
Yeah.
It's understandable where, for me, because my Switch is a home console, and home console first and foremost, it's like, I'll get it on the PC more than likely with a lot of stuff like that. But for people who are actually going to use it portably, unless they're going to carry a PC on their back, connect up to a car battery or something, I can't see them, you know, willing to do that. So Switch is a better looking prospect.
Until the Switch was revealed, I was very tempted to buy a gaming laptop just and maybe just keep it at work, just to play there.
Oh, I'm going to throw in Monster Boy.
What was that?
Monster Boy, it's the guy who created Wonder Boy. It's like a spiritual follow-up to it.
Oh yeah, I saw that. That actually looks pretty good as well.
And Wonder Boy, actually, which is out in April.
Yeah, really what I'm looking forward to is getting involved in kind of Switch Squad on the forums, because I completely missed all of Club U. I didn't have a Wii U. And there's like Mario Kart and Splatoon both look like tons of fun, so I'm really glad that they're coming to the Switch, and I think I'm going to really enjoy playing with hopefully some of you guys, hopefully some of the people listening. And yeah, it looks like there are some other like fun multiplayer experiences coming to the Switch. There's Fast RMX, which I'll get like as soon as they patch in like friends support, so that I can actually, you know, play online with you guys and, you know, my friends IRL who kind of own Switches. And there's going to be Ultra Street Fighter 2. I'm actually really looking forward to, because I'm a fan of the Street Fighter series, and I think that's, it's going to be like just like a cool little fighting game to actually have on the Switch. And ARMS, of course, looks pretty cool as well. So, yeah, I think there are some exciting times ahead for Switch Squad. Maybe the Tetris game, Puyo Puyo Tetris, is that right?
Yeah, did I say that right? Puyo Puyo. To be fair, I pronounced it the way you did until Kix said it out loud, and I thought, he probably knows more than I do.
Yeah, Puyo Puyo or something, probably.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
You know what we mean.
Yeah, yeah.
Puyo Puyo.
That's it. Puyo Puyo.
Yeah.
That Tetris game.
Yeah, I mean, that looks like it could be pretty cool if we could get some, like, you know, some regular games of that going as well. So just those kind of multiplayer experiences, which I kind of missed out on, you know, which are all happening on the forum. I think, you know, I'm pretty happy to have a chance to jump in with that now and kind of join that kind of sub-community, which I've kind of enviously looked at in the past. So that's going to be exciting for me over the next, you know, few months, 6 months or so.
The fact that we've been playing Mario Kart online regularly for nearly 3 years. I mean, we didn't start Mario Kart Mondays until a few months after the game launched, but that's because we spent a lot of time literally playing it literally every day. Like, that first month was insane. We'd play it literally every day, like, and all weekend. We'd get kicked from lobbies because of network issues, and then just go right back into it. Those were good times. So I'm really looking forward to that happening again. I mean, despite all the comments about how it's, you know, the same game and people aren't happy buying it again, I'm really looking at the people that didn't have Wii U and didn't buy the game, and them picking this up and them being the majority of the people online and just literally reliving that, because that was fantastic. And I've had an Xbox, so when people talk about Halo 2 and how good Xbox Live was in the early days, I never really knew what that was like, but this is a really good indication of what that was. So I can see I can see Mario Kart 8 Deluxe being a great experience online. So it makes me think that, yeah, this will definitely last a long time, and hopefully Splatoon will get a similar community on our side at least, because that is still popular online as well. I mean, like I said, I was playing it today, and it didn't take long to come into some games. I only stopped playing because I had other commitments. Otherwise, I'd have played it for a lot longer.
Okay, well, that's probably a good time to draw this to a close. This has been a pretty unrelentingly positive podcast, actually. And if one thing comes through, I hope it's really evident how much fun that we've all had with Zelda and the Switch. You know, I think it's fair to say all four of us are pretty big Nintendo fans. But even that aside, I think Zelda's, you know, we would all agree it's one of the best games we've ever played, and hopefully if you've listened to this and you haven't played it yet, hopefully that's, you know, communicated that to you. Maybe you'll give it a go, because it's a really special experience, and the Switch is looking like it could well be a really great console. So I think that kind of wraps it up for all of us. If you have any feedback about this podcast, please sign up to grk.co.uk. and post in the podcast thread. Let us know your thoughts. You know, if there is anything you want us to talk about, you know, in the next one, let us know. You know, any feedback, good or bad, we'd be really glad to hear it.
PM Captain Kill.
And yeah, that's it from all of us. Thank you so much for listening, and hopefully see you again soon. Goodbye from me.
And goodbye from me.
And me.
And him.
Good night. And cool. That's it. That's done.